Welcome to Same Surgeon, Different Life, part of the STS Surgical Hot Topics podcast. This series focuses on demystifying cardiothoracic surgery and presenting the remarkable backstories of surgeons from a variety of backgrounds and in various career stages that have led them to become the face of CT surgery. I'm Dr. David Tom Cook, and in each episode, Dr. Tom Varghese and I will get to know more about our colleagues, the obstacles, the success stories, trade-offs, and pivotal moments that have shaped their careers as well as their personal missions. The opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Society of Thoracic Surgeons. The program will return after a message from our sponsor.
The Society of Thoracic Surgeons Same Surgeon, Different Light podcast is sponsored by AstraZeneca, celebrating 25 years of creating innovative medicines and improving access to them.
Welcome to a very special episode of Same Surgeon, Different Life, a podcast brought to you by the Workforce of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion of the Society of Thoracic Surgeons. It's a little bit different from what we usually do. We are a podcast, so you just usually hear my voice. Now, unfortunately for you, you get to see me as well. But fortunately, you get to see my guests. Today, we are coming from the 60th Society of Thoracic Surgeons annual meeting held in San Antonio in January. And I have a special guest today, Dr. Mark Henderson, who's the Associate Dean of the University of California Davis School of Medicine, and Dr. Akinna Okereke, who is the Chief of Thoracic Surgery at Henry Ford Health. And we're going to talk about education from the beginning, so the entry to the pipeline, to undergraduate medical education or our medical schools, and how do we recruit a workforce that reflects the communities that we serve. We'll get also into a little bit of background into our guests, and we hope this will be a very enlightening and educational episode for all of you today. Well, thank you. Welcome. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
And this podcast is a continuation of our Vivian T. Thomas Symposium, which is actually the second Health Equity Summit performed at the STS, with the first one 20 years ago around this time. So, and you had some really interesting talks at this Health Equity Summit. Specifically, we talked about education and the role of education into providing a diverse workforce. So first off, I want to say, why is it important to have a diverse workforce?
Well, I think, thanks for the question and thanks for the opportunity, David. I think many of, hopefully our listeners know that healthcare in this country is not equal. So if you're from a poorer community, if you're from a marginalized community, if you're from a rural community, your health outcomes are not the same. And so I think that's called health disparity. And I think most of us who work in the space of trying to change that workforce are motivated by really the desire to make healthcare more equal, more equitable, to let everyone achieve an optimal sort of state of health, which is what health equity is. So that's really, to me, why diversity is important in healthcare. And honestly, the workforce we currently have is not reflective or representative of society. And we need to change that.
Yeah. Well, so I would echo those comments. One, thank you for having me. Thanks to STS for having us. I would absolutely echo those comments and say that we see the disparities, we talk about the disparities, and we have seen the benefits of diversity in other fields in our field. I think you brought up a great point earlier today. I think that there's this notion that you have to increase diversity at the expense of talent or at the expense of productivity. And I think one of the things hopefully we can do today and we can do going forward is understand that those two things are not mutually exclusive. You said, in fact, they're tied together. Diversity brings increased output, becomes increased efficacy, increased results, improved results, I should say. And so I think for all of us, we see these disparities and we think, what if the workforce were more representative? would we have helped in this one particular case, reach out to this patient, reduce the mistrust in this case, et cetera?
So, you know, we talked about diverse teams. The result is greater than the individual parts. And we see that in the private sector. So McKinsey has put out data for the last several years that companies with diverse boards and diverse executive leadership have better profit outcomes. Where is this data in healthcare? Do we have data that diverse workforces, diverse clinicians provide improved outcomes for underserved communities?
Well, I'll say briefly, I think the short answer is yes. I think you can expand on it more. The short answer is yes, in thoracic surgery, in surgery in general, in medicine in general. If you have more diverse teams, you get better satisfaction scores from patients and better outcomes in a list of metrics.
Yeah, I think the only thing I would add to what Ike said is if we think about what we as physicians, surgeons, or anyone in medicine does, is we try to get patients honest to change something, whether it's to change their behavior. Honestly, often it's to change their behavior. And sometimes that means for them giving up something, giving up having side effects from a medication, undertaking risk of a surgical procedure. These things require trust. And trust is the essence of medicine in any specialty. And I think that's really where the evidence comes, is that when you have an understanding of who your patients are, where they come from, or you speak their language, share their culture, they trust you more. And I think when you think about how important trust is in health outcomes, that's really the essence of it. Right? So I think that evidence is emerging, you know, in different ways, with different outcomes. Since this is a surgical audience, I'm intrigued and I'm pleased by the recent studies of surgical outcomes in women versus men, you know, which are in many respects superior. So it's an interesting time.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that there are a few studies out there for looking at women surgeons compared to men surgeons. Some of those studies show that perhaps women surgeons have better outcomes than men. That may look at maybe the approach of listening to the patient, empathy perhaps, or identifying outcomes that are most important to patients and prioritize like that. And then there are other studies that show that there's no difference between outcomes for women surgeons compared to men surgeons. And perhaps you look at that it's not inferiority, that women surgeons are equal to male surgeons in regards to technical ability and ability to assess a patient.
Yeah, if I could add to that quickly, I hope that we can dispel this notion that we're accepting female surgeons in and getting them by, that they're just barely, they, you know, stay under the radar and barely treading water. I think if you look at the obstacles that some women have had to face to get to where they have had to get to, exactly, just dispel that notion. They're equal, if not better, in all aspects, and we should treat them as such.
You know, we have these conversations about diversity, and the term diversity, for whatever reason, has become a hot button term. And when we think of diversity, oftentimes the feedback that I get is, well, we shouldn't look at what a person looks like or their background. All I want is the best. It's this concept of merit and diversity being mutually exclusive. Is that a valid argument? Are they mutually exclusive? In order to have a diverse workforce, are you bringing in inferior talent?
Yeah, it's a common, maybe, conundrum, David. I think that the idea that we certainly have where I am is that the diverse talent, diverse perspectives coming from diverse places and having lived experiences is actually a strength. It's an asset that allows you to connect with patients, one, and to establish trust, two. And those things, when you see them and I've seen them many times, and I'm not a surgeon, by the way, I'm an internist, but I see students and trainees, black students, for instance, meeting a Black patient, I'll tell this anecdote. I had a patient that I was taking care of, African-American woman, who I had introduced to one of our second year medical students, who's a Black woman who's going into actually primary care. And she, the patient asked me at the end of the encounter, you know, again, second year medical student, can she be my doctor? And I said, well, yes, in five years, maybe. But I think the point of that story is that I think when you see the facial expression, the engagement, the kind of just the whole temperature of the room change when someone, a patient sees someone that they feel respects them, can understand where they've been, where they've come from. That's, again, I go back, it's the essence of the doctor-patient relationship. And I think it applies across different specialties. And so I think those students, that diversity is only an asset. It's a strength. It's not a weakness. I do think we need to change that narrative.
And along those lines, I try to look at, as a program director, when I think about who to pick, I try to look at maybe not the person with the most quote unquote accomplishments, by what we consider accomplishments, the one with the most potential. So I'm from Michigan. I grew up in Detroit. I live in Detroit now. I bleed maize and blue. Go blue. And our former coach, who will now be in Los Angeles, said about another coach that just because you're standing on third base doesn't mean you hit a triple if you're just born on third base. So to that end, I want the person who has the most chance to succeed. And that may not necessarily be the standard metrics that we look at, but it may be some of the intangibles unmeasured. And to do that, you have to give people an opportunity to be able to see that.
So, you know, we talk about things like quotas and tokenism. And tokenism imply that someone is in a position only because of their demographic and not because of merit. We talk about quotas, that we have to have a number of types of people, not because of merit. And what can happen, it seems, is that people can conflate with that point of view that any person who's a person of color in a position, or any person who's a woman in a position, is there because of their demographic and not because of merit. You know, Ike, looking at your background, typical cardiothoracic surgical leader. And when I say typical cardiothoracic surgical leader, I say that with great respect, right? So high school, straight A's, SAT, high score, got into college, high grades, high MCAT score, got into med school, performed well in rotations, high USMLE step one scores, high USMLE step two scores, got into residency, general surgery residency, high abside scores, great letters of recommendation, then get into cardiothoracic surgical fellowship, performed well, graduated, passed the board, step one, great job, high performance in promotion, now a leader. But then when someone sees you, they say, oh, a token. And that doesn't make sense from the data. How does that make you feel? Because I'm sure you've heard that before.
Yeah, great question. So I say, I use it as a source of motivation. So at every step along the way, at least once, it's happened to you, I'm sure as well, I've been called affirmative action. I distinctly remember Johns Hopkins, affirmative action student, and then affirmative action resident, and affirmative action doctor. Literally, I've heard this from someone say to me at least once at every point of my career. And I say that, and what I try to instill to the young kids that I mentor, is that you're going to face these things. So people are going to say some of these things to you and call you an affirmative action doctor or token doctor or don't belong here. Use that as motivation. And then we're in positions now where, maybe unlike some of the people we're trying to promote, we have the ability to affect some of those standardized metrics that people look for success. NIH grants, number of publications, number of presentations, et cetera. And I hope for all of us who have made it to this position, we use that as extra incentive to overcome that bias by shining and showing all of those metrics. And then at the very least, if they look at me without looking at the resume and say, you're this, you show them the resume, you show them the standardized And that's a way to not only shut them up about you, but about other people that you're trying to bring up. That's how I try to view some of those things I hear, which I still hear.
Now, you mentioned affirmative action. And just like many talking points in society, whether it's the term woke or DEI, hashtag DEI, or CRT, hashtag CRT, affirmative action has become a hashtag about sort of an understanding of what affirmative action is or the actual role of affirmative action in society and what percentage of a role it is in society. What is affirmative action?
I think people, it's a great point. There's a lot of conflation and a lot of misunderstanding what affirmative action is. I mean, this is JFK's vision of affirmative action was to correct a wrong. And that wrong actually was the fact that African Americans weren't being hired for the same jobs, in the same percentages, weren't being paid the same amount. It was meant to address a wrong. But why? Because it was the right thing to do. That's an argument. That's the justice argument for affirmative action. I think, you know, things have changed. You know, a lot's happened since then. But I think the we still have injustices in society. But in healthcare, the injustices and disparities I mentioned at the outset are still present. So to me, what affirmative action means to me now is we have to be working to correct those wrongs. Why? Again, because it's the right thing to do. It's the just thing to do. Medicine is largely, and this is a little bit to what Ike just said, it's what we have to do now after his long road to cardiothoracic surgery is we have to educate the others that are part of this guild. Medicine is, in my view, too much of a guild. It's too much of a club. It's a legacy system. And when you're a legacy system, you tend to preserve the status quo. The people, what you think is meritorious is what you did the way you got there and the traditional measures are in my view, off base. They exclude way too many segments of America. And we all believe that it's right to have everybody, give everybody a fair opportunity at education, at health. So affirmative action, again, yeah, to me is about justice.
And then to your point about buzzwords exist now, they've existed in the past, they'll exist in the future. I think I've always believed in the process. If the process is true, the result will follow. I think the arc of history bends toward justice. And so I think that we have to understand that if we have a sound process and we persist and we persist every day, you make it your mission, you're intentional about it, then ultimately the results will come. 60 years ago, Martin Luther King Jr. was vilified. And even as early as 30 years ago, there are people who are living today who voted against his day as being a federal holiday. And now everyone, you know, considers him a hero and posts his picture at least once a year on social media. So I think that the buzzwords like diversity and affirmative action and woke, apparently woke's a bad thing, I guess, all of those things today, hopefully 10, 20 years from now for our efforts, will be looked at as nonsense.
You know, we look at affirmative, the concept of affirmative action, as Mark, as you pointed out, it was designed by JFK and his advisors as a means to develop justice. So in order to have justice, that implies that there is an injustice going on. And that injustice is basically racism in the form of actual racism, racism in the form of structural racism, the system itself, and racism in the form of unconscious bias, right? That we all have some sort of bias that we are not aware, but it affects how we approach. So that means, really what that means is that qualified, meritorious individuals are not allowed into the system, that they are not being recruited, they're not being offered interviews, and then potentially not being hired. When we look at the actual concept of affirmative action, the Supreme Court has just struck down affirmative action. But the reality is less than 30% of colleges in the United States prior to that decision, use race as a basis for admissions. And then in the state of California, affirmative action was struck down in 1997. Is that correct, Mark?
Yes, that's right, David. So we've in California, which is a very, as you all know, a diverse state in terms of race, ethnicity, class. It's a very large state. Banned affirmative action in 1997. So all public universities and institutions were banned from considering race and a number of other what they call protected categories, gender and others. So we have been in a similar place for almost 30 years. Now, there are affirmative action bans in 8 other states prior to the Supreme Court decision. In all 8 states, after those bans, the enrollment of historically marginalized communities, Black students, Latino students, as well as American Indian, Alaska Native students, fell by approximately 35% in all those states. So I predict and suspect that after this SCOTUS decision, there will be a decline in representation amongst many schools. Now, as you said, David, most of this, where the biggest effects will be on the sort of prestigious universities, Ivy League schools. That's really where I expect to see more of the effect, the negative effect, if you will. The other institutions in our place, community colleges, and actually I should say community colleges across the United States are much more reflective of society. They're much more diverse in every possible way, economically, racially, ethnically. And so we have always prioritized and looked in the community colleges in our local community because there's a rich pool of talent in all those places that you don't, you know, people are in community college usually because they don't have financial means, or maybe they're working a job, maybe they have a family. So again, they have the experience, the lived experience that a lot of our patients have and a lot of our patients struggle with. And that's why I think they're the key in many respects to this building trust and to health equity in the future. But remember with SCOTUS, it's about admissions to college. It's not about admissions to, let's say, residency. So there's going to be a little bit of a nuanced approach as we go forward when we think about residency training.
Employees,
generally speaking.
Okay. We call it graduate medical education.
Yeah.
But we're really, it's really professional education.
Yeah.
Right? Because they're employees.
Yep. No, and I think what people misunderstand in California, Proposition 209, which is the affirmative action ban, does actually apply to residency training, but it is more restrictive, more prohibitive than the Supreme Court decision, which only applies to higher education admissions. So that's principally college admissions. So,
and I'll say one of the things I learned, Mark, and I'll plug your program and all the work that you've done most specifically. I was very encouraged to see what has happened at your institution and what you've done in the last 25 years since the California ruling. So I think that the roadmap exists, and I think what has been done at UC Davis can be mimicked elsewhere to hopefully try to mitigate some of the negative effects.
So we're going to get back to sort of recruitment at the undergraduate medical education level. So in the world of medical education, undergraduate medical education are medical students, and graduate medical education are residents and fellows. One key distinction, California aside, right? But outside of California and maybe a few other states, affirmative action only refers to college admissions, perhaps with extrapolation, medical school admissions. But it doesn't refer to graduate medical education, which are employees or workforce. There's a concern amongst individuals that in our world of misinformation and conflation, that the Supreme Court striking down affirmative action gives people the free rein to discriminate at every level, including graduate medical education. I can't look at race as a demographic. I can't consider other things as a demographic to recruit for a residency position, which is not in the Supreme Court ruling. Like, as a program director, what is your approach now to recruitment?
So I think that you have to be very intentional about these factors and these. As I said, I try to look at each applicant and look for what I think is potential. And that is very difficult, no question. But I very, to answer your question, I have a very low threshold for some of the standard metrics like test scores or publications, presentations, et cetera. I have a very low threshold and I do base things more on the interview, the word of mouth, and maybe other factors and other aspects of their CV, which may not have been highlighted by other people, the initiative, the experiences they may have had, something in the personal statement. So I try to look at more of the intangibles, but it's difficult.
You know, Mark, UC Davis School of Medicine has a class that's the most diverse class outside of the historically black colleges and university medical school affiliates. And from 1997, I believe, when Prop 209 was ratified, on the curve of diversity within the School of Medicine has markedly increased. How is that and why is that?
Well, the first thing I'd say is it has been a slow, iterative process and a steady increase in representation at UC Davis. I think that is a result of many different interventions. I think one of the principal ones is something Ike just alluded to when he looks at residency applications, which is how can I look at this person as an individual? That's what's known as holistic recruitment is a sort of phrase for that, which means, you know, this individual is more than his or her test scores. This individual has a unique life experiences that bring something important and of value to medicine, to healthcare. So we've definitely focused on looking at candidates in what I consider to be a more holistic way, a broader way, one that really adds that prioritizes their experience, one, and also de-emphasizes those things that we know have to do with educational opportunities and privilege. For instance, students who come from wealthy families, students who come from physician families, they have a lot of advantages. And at the other end of the socioeconomic spectrum, or as kids from poor minority neighborhoods can attest to, there are many disadvantages. And so what we've tried to do at UC Davis is really try to get a sense of, and even measure, the degree of hurdles and barriers that individuals have had to overcome. And so we've actually put a numeric quantity to that. It's not perfect, but at least it gives some of our admissions committee members perspective into the fact that this number that you're looking at actually is influenced by a lot of other things besides, quote, merit. And a lot of those other things have to do with, again, opportunity and privilege and resources.
And I'll add to that because I think we want to reach out to everyone. I think one thing which some people take from what we're saying is that, well, if you came from a privileged background, you didn't have to work hard. I hope everyone understands we're not saying that. Yeah. We know you had to put in 100 hours a week back in the pre-80-hour work, and you had to spend those nights, and you lost your 20s and 30s in education and then in the hospital. We understand people have had to work hard. What we're saying is that you were given an opportunity, perhaps more likely to get that opportunity than others, and we just want to give others that opportunity. That's all we're saying. We're not trying to villainize or criminalize or take away the accomplishments of people who have made it, who may have come from not as stark of circumstances. I just want to make sure we point that out.
No, and I would add to Ike what you just said, that those, I think we just want to give context. And so someone who's come from a privileged background, well, maybe we might expect a little more of them. In some sense. And again, but I think more importantly, the converse.
Yeah.
Someone who's really, really been kept out at many points in the process, we really should do the converse with them. That is to give them a little bit of a closer look, to give them to look at what they've had to overcome. Because medicine, I mean, it's a marathon. You know, you have to have persistence. You have to be able to get up and after you fall. You have to, keep climbing the mountain, you know, when you stumble.
So, you know, given that sort of holistic recruitment, it's always a challenge when you're a person of color, but you are in a high income bracket, right?
Yeah.
So your person of color is a cardiothoracic surgeon. And but in society, you're still considered a person of color. So how in a recruitment process like that, how do you reconcile that sort of class distinction that may exist for certain segments of society, but in other segments of society, it doesn't matter. They have an advantage, sure, but maybe not as much of an advantage as we might think based on their demographics.
Yeah,
is that reconcilable?
I think it's hard. I'll just say it's hard to disentangle race from class, although they are separate, and of course they have different effects on people's opportunities. because in our state, we're prohibited from considering race. Our measures don't have anything to do with race. They have only to do with socioeconomic variables, simply because we are prohibited from doing so. And I don't think that goes far enough. It doesn't capture the experience of a Black person, even someone who comes from a more privileged or environment or family, because there is also a negative effect and discrimination that goes along with that experience. And that, I would say, as people look towards the future, the post-affirmative action future, individuals from persons of color in that, you know, should not hesitate to speak about their experiences as a member of that. Of that group, because I think that, well, not I think, that is, even Justice Roberts said that's acceptable. It's not illegal, and it's not, you know, it's not a problem for people to talk about their experiences of race and racism in their personal comments, their personal statement. That's where I think we can still hopefully get at a sense of whether that individual understands. And again, to me, it's all about, we're in medicine, right? It's about the patients. What we're doing all has to be aimed at improving the care of patients. That, you know, medical education, David, you mentioned graduate medical education, right? Residency programs are largely funded by the taxpayers of the United States in the Medicare Trust Fund. So education of residents is a public good. And I think we owe the public something for that investment. We owe them the idea that we would produce physicians that are going to improve society, the health of all members of society, to the extent that we can.
So it's really the onus and the fiduciary responsibility of a program director to actually read that personal statement and get that sort of understand that rich background of that candidate. You know, one of the great things about the Vivian Thomas Symposium at the annual meeting is the discussion that occurs and the questions that come from the audience. And I remember at the last annual meeting, someone came up to the microphone and said, you know, I'm really overwhelmed by this data about the social determinants of health and how it affects the pathway from someone from childhood all the way to either a patient or the ability to enter our workforce. And, you know, how can I, as a community-based cardiac surgeon, actually make an impact when the social determinants of health are so vast and pervasive and structuralized? But then you've developed a program that addresses that at the early stages of a learner and potential trainee.
Yeah, so this is a high school program we started 8 years ago. To take a step back to talk about race and class, quick story. I was 10 years old when I received my first ticket, and I was on my bicycle. I was with three other of my friends. I was the only minority, and the police officer said I stopped ran a stop sign, stopped me only, detained me because they didn't think I belonged in the neighborhood. Drove me back home and had my parents identify me. Luckily, it was a Saturday. I was only 10 years old, and I remember how unfair it was. You know, it was so unfair, in fact, my dad wanted to teach me a lesson and, you know, fight, and we went to court, and I was found guilty. So I think I'm an ex-con or a felon. I don't know if I'm allowed to vote. My juvie record. My point is that I remember how unfair that was, even at such a young age, even when I'm still trying to figure things out about life in the world. And I tried to use that as motivation for what I do. segue 8 years ago for particular reasons. I decided we need to start a program because there aren't enough applicants. I took every applicant and we still wouldn't have a very diverse program because we don't have enough applicants of diverse fields. And so I started a high school program. We've now expanded it and made it larger. But in essence, we bring high school students, mostly underrepresented, into our community, into our hospital, and teach them surgical skills, expose them to trainees at various levels. And what we've seen when we look at some of the pre and post evaluations is a significant increase in the number of people who are interested in going into medicine. And 8 years later, most people are still on track to become doctors.
And how difficult was it to, I mean, obviously it's difficult, but is it, can it be replicated?
I think it can be. I think people have to understand that it's not easy to start initially. A lot of people will tell you no. Administrators will tell you no. The simulation lab will tell you no. A lot of people will say no. And you just have to find ways to either go around or be creative or make it opportunity or gain, I should say, for some of the other people. But you can make it work. I think you just have to understand that it takes a while. Start small. You grow the program eventually and bring as many people as you can in there.
You know, you mentioned Detroit. You know, Detroit is a fascinating city. It's, you know, one of the shining examples of a metropolis in the United States, but it has its challenges. And you are someone who's well-trained, high H index, and you came to Detroit, to Michigan and Detroit, and I would think to restore the health of that community. But you're from this community. Did that play a part in you coming back and benefiting this community?
100%. I feel like every day is living a dream. So I specifically came back to Detroit because it is personal to me, and I did grow up there. And once again, I remember some of the specific unfair, I keep them on a board. I keep receipts, as the kids say nowadays. I remember some of the things that happened, and I had such a motivation to come back and try to prepare students so that they either don't have to face those obstacles, or if they do face those obstacles, are better prepared than I was when I was 10 years old and when I was in high school and college and et cetera to handle those. So that, and I think to that end, if you can do something that you feel is your, not only your career, but is your life mission, it makes it a lot more fun. And I think you're probably better at it. So
that's a perfect example of why diversifying the workforce is important to better our communities.
Yeah, can I add to something Ike said, which is, and this is really important, is that that lived experience of your community is something very deep and something very important that is not measured in the process that we, when we look at candidates, yet it is so important. And all of us, most of us in academic medicine, are living in, if you will, living, our institutions are situated in places like Detroit, like Atlanta, like, you know, very diverse communities that have wonderfully rich histories and a really incredibly diverse people living there, right there. So, I mean, to me, we ought to be looking in our own neighborhood, our own high schools, our own community colleges. Again, community colleges are much more representative of the United States of America than are big, you know, highfalutin Ivy League colleges and universities. So we can only need to look to our own neighborhoods to find rich talent for the future workforce of medicine.
So, you know, I know I want the two of you to enjoy the rest of the meeting and everything that San Antonio has to offer. Before we conclude, I always ask at the end of the podcast, what do you think is the future of cardiothoracic surgery? We'll tweak that a little bit and say, from your perspective, what is the future of cardiothoracic surgery, graduate medical education?
I think it's bright. I think more people are understanding that there is a significant demand, supply-demand need for cardiothoracic surgeons. Many of the cardiothoracic surgeons are aged, will retire soon. The population's getting older, getting more cardiothoracic diseases, lung cancer screening. For a lot of reasons, we need many more cardiothoracic surgeons. And now is a wonderful time to get into cardiothoracic surgery. It's clearly a demanding field. There are very sick patients. It's not an easy residency and fellowship. But I think that one of the things that you have done, you have excelled at in your career, that I've tried to do, is to show that being a cardiothoracic surgeon is much more than just the hospital nowadays. You can be a cardiothoracic surgeon and be a community leader and be someone who extends what you do well outside the walls of the hospital, well outside the operating room. I think you and I probably trained in that era where cardiothoracic surgeon was in the hospital 20 hours a day doing 5,000 cases a year, and that was his or her value, and most of the time his value. And now I think that we can create a cardiothoracic surgeon who's probably much better well-rounded and much more effective to the community than just revascularizing your coronary vessel that's obstructed or resecting your lung cancer or esophageal cancer.
You know, one of my mentors once said that being a thoracic surgeon is like being a primary care doctor for the lungs. Mark, I'm going to give you a little bit harder question. What do you think is the future of medical education in this country?
Yeah, I think that, you know, I'm a little worried with the Supreme Court decision, as I said earlier, that we will slip back in terms of, again, I'll say representation broadly defined, racial and ethnic representation, economic representation. I think the economic piece concerns me the most because the gaps in our society between the wealthy and the poor are widening. And I think unless we are intentional, and this is why I'm very inspired by this meeting, I'm very inspired by the work Ike's done in his local, in his community. I'm optimistic, but we have to be very intentional and we have to commit to, and we all need to be on board, not just surgeons. Again, I said I'm an internist, but we all need to be on board with this. We all need to work together. This problem is too big. The problem I mean is that healthcare is not equal. And we all believe it should be, I think. And so we need to work across the lines, work together to try to break this down.
Well, incredible conversation. Mark, UC Davis School of Medicine, Ike, Henry Ford Health. I really appreciate your thoughts and your insights and how our membership can help our communities and help our learners and help our trainees. Thank you. And this concludes another wonderful episode of Same Surgeon, Different Life. This has been Same Surgeon, Different Life, a podcast brought to you by the Society of Thoracic Surgeons. Thank you for listening. If you like this podcast, please rate it 5 stars and let your friends, trainees, and colleagues know about it. On social media, you can use the hashtag #TheFaceOfCTSurgery. More information about the Society of Thoracic Surgeons is available online at sts.org.